Welcome to meeting number 4 of a 5-day online intensive with John Sherman, broadcast live from Ojai, California on June 27th, 2013.
Hi everybody, this is John. I'm happy to be here and happy to see you guys here. Yesterday we talked about, I actually spent a long time talking about the way in which this whole idea of looking at yourself came to be in the course of our time in this life, actually, and what the looking consists in, and what the problem is that it cures, and so forth and so on. Today I want to talk a little bit about what happens after the act of looking takes place, what the experience is after the act of looking takes place, and the context of fearfulness is extinguished. We have become, many of us have become, accustomed to the idea that once a problem is solved, the problem is solved and we don't have to think about it anymore. You know, if you're sick and you take medicine and get well, you don't have to think about that being sickness anymore. And the truth is that once the act of looking actually takes place, the disease has been conquered. It is no more. The underlying, as I think I said, autoimmune disease that the fear of life consists in is gone. The fear of life itself, as we spoke about earlier, the fear of life itself, the experience of it is very faint to begin with, and we're not even aware of it. And when it goes, therefore, we are not really aware of anything having changed whatsoever, for at least for the better. It's not like the context of the fear of life is snuffed out and everything turns to clarity and ease of being and everything coming up roses instantaneously. Because you see, it wasn't our experience of fearfulness that is the fear of life that was ever the problem, because we have very little direct experience of that underlying context of fearfulness. We have very little direct experience of that at all. For the most part, none. It is too faint, too overwhelmed by all the other stimuli rushing in on us and crying out for our attention. So when it goes, there is seldom, there might be a brief period of relief and of relief from the burden, but that goes quickly, usually, goes quickly. Because the problem was the problem insofar as the problem of us in the experience of our lives and the relationship with our lives, that problem is entirely psychological. It is the entire host of habits of behavior, habits of understanding, beliefs, assumptions, invisible and visible, ideas about things, thoughts about things, definitions of things, proper relationship with things, with experiences and events arising within our awareness, within our mind. That is the problem. That whole kind of orchestra, the whole kind of out-of-tune orchestra of psychology that's operating, that came into being, was formed and defined by the assumption that the main thing to know about life as a human being is that it's dangerous, untrustworthy, and mostly painful and disappointing. So those artifacts remain for a time. They don't all fall away at once, and some of them take quite a while to fall away. Those artifacts of the fear remain for some time, and in the period immediately following the success of the act of looking, you can expect maybe some confusion, some anxiety, unfocused aggressiveness arising from what might seem to be inexplicable shifts in mood and general disposition, and all of that alternating with periods of clarity and purposeful attention to the affairs of life. Now this is the time, you know, as I've tried to make clear all along, our understanding of what this is and what it consists in and what it implies and so forth is constantly filling in as we speak to people and as we talk to one another and so forth. In any event, that's what you can expect. You can expect that there will be times when the persistence of the disease, the effects of the disease on the psychology, because that's really the problem. That's it. The cause is the fear of life. The problem is the disease psychology. And in the period immediately after eliminating the cause of it, those things persist for a while. And they alternate with periods of clarity and satisfaction and so forth. And that can cause considerable confusion, apprehension even. Anxiety. What's actually taking place, is the disintegration and regeneration of the psychological apparatus that is the means by which we experience and engage with life itself. It is the psychological structure and apparatus that gives us the capability of looking outward, of engaging with life, of understanding things, of being involved in things, and so forth. And that psychology, the disease psychology, is beginning to fall away, and it's being replaced by as it falls away, new psychological structures are arising, so that the entire psychology, in the end, is completely regenerated. But the period in which that disintegration and regeneration is taking place can be confusing and difficult and painful. And as I was saying, we're learning about this, and the more experience that people have, the more people who have experience of what happens as a result of this work, the more understanding is available to all of us to look at what actually happens and consider what the likely cause of those effects would be, and what is useful to do to like fully realize the experience of being in existence as a human being while all this is taking place. Because, you know, it's not like this happens and then everything's clean. It's not like this happens and then we just have to endure the ups and downs and the confusion and the smoke and dust of the disintegration of this diseased psychology. It is in that experience of life as it changes, as the underlying fearfulness departs. It is that that's happening right there that is our lives right there, just as they are. That's what our lives are feeling like. Our lives are feeling like sometimes anxious and aggressive and clear and purposeful and all of those things shifting in a way that's extremely complicated and confusing. But that's the way our life is unfolding. So that it behooves us, instead of just resorting to the old methods when faced with difficult problems, the old methods of whatever they happen to be in the individual. You know, some of them are things of the nature of denial and withdrawal and all kinds of things like that. Instead of resorting to the old methods, the old habitual methods of dealing with situations that are problematic, we can begin to learn what is actually occurring here and learn how to learn freshly in a way that we never could before the useful and productive and satisfying way to engage with life as it actually is, as it actually unfolds before our eyes. And that's what is possible to begin as soon as possible after having accomplished the act of looking in the midst of the confusion and disarray that sometimes follows that. And it's there that, so far as I can tell from my own experience and from the experience of others now, that the most useful thing that can happen at any time, in good times or bad times, the most useful thing that we can do at any time is to begin to understand and recognize and become more intelligent and skillful at the power we have to decide, if we choose to do so, to decide where to put our attention, to decide what in all the universe of experience and situation that is arising within me, what is the best, the most useful place, the most useful thing to attend to, and what things are there, what are the things that I can safely decline to attend to. The development of the strength and intelligence in directing our attention is the best thing that can possibly happen to us. It is the only thing we can do. And to learn how to do it intelligently, sanely, and deliberately is the most satisfying thing that I know of in my experience with living life in the absence of that context of fear. So we advise that from the very beginning, people in that period when things are wacky, begin to train attention, begin to, and it doesn't mean that you have to always get it, and that you always have to be aware of what you should do, or that you always have to be alert to the opportunity to engage in this. The truth is that the times when you are aware of what's happening and alert to the opportunity to engage in it are not yours to decide, and it's just the way in which the whole of life is unfolding, and including the characteristics of the mechanism you have for engaging with life. But every once in a while, you will find, and this is whether you're in the period that we used to call recovery or beyond that period, every once in a while you will find that you notice that your attention is resting on, is fixated on, some cluster of thoughts that are negative and kind of sickly. Some cluster of thoughts that are that feel bad, that don't feel good. And when you notice that that's happening, and as I said, you're not going to notice it all the time, but the more you practice, the more often you will notice these things. When you notice that that's happening, that you're intently engaged in some cluster of thoughts about how terrible things are, you can just lightheartedly as possible, just decline to attend to those thoughts for a moment, and instead move your attention to, and there's a reason for going in this order too, and I'll say something about it in a minute. Notice that you're fixated on a cluster of thought, and then just lightheartedly and with no particular aggression or anything, move the beam of your attention looking for the sensation, because these thoughts are always about some sensation that's present. And it may be a sensation that is very subtle, may not be very subtle, but they're always about some current sensation. So you notice that you're watching these thoughts very intently, and then you just say, okay, well, and then look for, with your attention, look for the sensation that the thoughts are talking about. Just touch it for a moment, and then bring your attention to the experience of breathing, the actual sensation of breathing. Now, and then put your attention wherever you want to until the next episode of having your attention hijacked by old ideas. And the reason for doing it in that order is because when our attention is hijacked, when we're completely unaware even of our ability to deliberately move our attention from one thing to another, the most interesting thing and the reason we are there is the thoughts. That's what catches our attention. The thoughts. The thoughts are very interesting to us. So we get a moment of respite from being blind to our attachment to this cluster of thoughts. And the next most interesting thing is the sensation that the thoughts are talking about. So we move to that, just for a moment. It's not to understand it or to make it change or do anything with it, just to look at it for a moment, and then to our breath. And the reason for moving to our breath is because our breath is physical and uncomplicated and reliable. So that is what I really, really strongly advise to anyone who has done this act of looking and who has found themselves noticeably different in the way that they're relating to experience and life and so forth, that as soon as possible you begin to train yourself to control the only thing that you can control, which is where to put your attention. Because I tell you that from then on in, intelligently putting your attention in the place where it will do the most good actually is the only thing that can affect that can have an effect on the way life unfolds. Now, how long does it last? Well, you know, it's not, again, if we recognize the fact that the period that from the moment that that fear is gone, if we recognize the fact that everything has been done that can be done, except for us now to learn how to skillfully and effectively be alive as human beings in an actual human life, then we see that it will actually never end. Our skill will grow, our understanding will grow, our ability to look at what we want to look at and not look at what we don't want to look at will grow and increase for the rest of our lives. The business of being alive as a human being, the business of sane, clear, intelligent engagement with the experience of life as it comes and goes, rises and falls and so forth, well, that's the treasure. And that treasure is in our hands from the moment that context of fear disappears. That treasure is ours from that moment, from no matter how intense and confusing and crazy the immediate experience of that may be, that's there then, that capacity to seek intelligent, sane, clear, self-reliant engagement with the way in which our life is unfolding, with the living of our life. So that never ends. There's no ending. There's no time when you become absolute clarity and absolute intelligence and absolute whatever. You remain human. But now you remain really human with the capacity to become saner, to become clearer, to develop more intelligence, to become skillful in engagement with life. And that's where the satisfaction comes. Now another thing that happens, and this has been something we've seen for a while now, another thing that happens after the fear departs and after the mind itself has gone through the process of healing is the rising inclination to a kind of benevolent disinterest in human affairs. For some, the previous attraction to good works turns out to have been full of the stain of fear. And in those cases, that attraction to good works will kind of disappear when the fear is gone. And when that attraction disappears, it leaves us with a little energetic motivation to change anything. As I said, there's an inclination to a kind of benevolent disinterest in the way human affairs unfold. Perhaps due to a partial understanding of the insignificance in a cosmic sense of the human story and how it plays out and how it ends. And of course that sense of insignificance of the outcome of the human story in a cosmic sense is itself entirely leftovers from the time of distrust and fearfulness and anxiety. But it happens. the preference sometimes, well, the preference always is to be alert, self-reliant, and engaged with the endlessly changing experience of life as it is, rather than attending to matters that are not directly impinging on the experience of life. And this leads to the question, why bother trying to bring this to people at all? What in the world is to, you know, why? When you're satisfied with your life, when you have received the treasure, and you have come through the period of confusion that follows that, and you are content and engaged and satisfied and nourished by the experience of your life, why bother to take it anywhere else? If everything is as good as it can be, what is to be gained by going out to the world to try to bring this to anybody? I mean, certainly you would be willing to have it available to people should they be able to find it on their own, but why would you bother to take it out, deliberately take it out into the world? What is there that would overcome the inertia of satisfaction with life? Well, first of all, it turns out that we are literally and inextricably connected to one another. And this shouldn't come as a big surprise, because we have the experience of that all the time. When we are caught up in our own concerns about the misery of our own lives or the stupidity of our lives and so forth and so on, that kind of drowns it out. But even then, you must have had the experience of being in a group of people in which the energy there was unpleasant, and where you had a natural inclination to want to move away from it. You were kind of out of your comfort zone. We've all had that experience, and God knows, I'm very familiar with that experience. I spent a lot of time in a circumstance that was energetically unpleasant. So the reason for that is because we have within our consciousness some connection to the experience other people are having with their own lives. That's what I have spoken about and will always point out. That is what goes by the name of compassion. Compassion, at its root, has the meaning of to suffer with another, to suffer another's pain, to suffer another's torment. And it is the case that, and it doesn't matter why or what sense it makes or doesn't make, it is the case that we experience one another's misery. And the closer we are to one another physically, in physical proximity, the stronger that experience of the misery of others becomes. That's what compassion is. And compassion, it, for some, and I personally think, that the only that it is entirely the particular way in which the circumstances of life require require a person that the way the circumstances of life unfold within a particular life, it is entirely that which causes some people to feel or to actually act by trying to bring help to others when help is available. And some people react to the compassionate experience with, again, based entirely on the way in which their life is itself unfolding. They experience that as an inclination to withdraw from engagement with the misery of human beings. And that's really probably the smartest the smartest route to take. But as I said, I think what determines whether that happens is just the inexplicable cause and effect unfolding of the life itself. So that Carla and I, our situation, the unfolding of our lives as it is, for Carla and I, the circumstantial nature of the way our lives have manifested together over the last 14 years. For Carla and I, the way those lives have developed have led us without concern for what we might rather do or might rather not do, have led us irresistibly to the point where our entire lives are given over to the effort to bring this simple act of looking to every human being. And having been put in this position, it becomes obvious to me that the possibility of all of humanity going sane is exhilarating. And so that although our lives have, and the momentum and the direction and inertia of our lives have brought us to this point, there is nowhere in the world I would rather be. Because the what's possible if humanity goes sane is, well, it's worth working for. So, for me, the best thing to do with all of the results of the looking that have come to me and to Carla, for me, the way in which this life is moving has caused me to want nothing in the world more than to have every human being just have the opportunity to try that simple act once. You see, the thing about this is that it's not like other things that we have done in the past, other beliefs and other practices and other understandings and so forth. This is not, the looking is not a thing in itself that can survive the sanity of the human creature. The looking is a possibility that has appeared to us because of the whole circumstance of the development of this world and this human creature. And what I think is that if we can get just almost everybody, or maybe just the majority of every human being, to just try this act, not to believe in it, not to make a doctrine of it, not to worship it or care about it in any way whatsoever, except as an instrument to bring about an end to the feeling that life itself is a burden. There's nothing I'd rather do. Imagine it. Imagine a world free of human insanity and neuroses and stupidity. Imagine a world of human beings that no longer raise their fists against one another, that no longer steal from one another. Imagine a world of human beings in which human beings and humanity itself is sane, self-reliant, intelligent, and engaged with life as a human being. I guess that's pretty much what I have to say about what comes in the aftermath of actually doing the act and ridding yourself of the disease. I've tried to give a sense of what the experience of it is in the beginning and how to make good use of the confusion that ensues in the beginning of the period after the destruction of the context of fear. And I've tried to show you that the sooner you begin to learn how to take responsibility for your own attention, the sooner you begin to train yourself in that regard, the sooner you will see the treasure, the real treasure that comes from intelligent, sane, fearless engagement with life as a human being. And I've tried to show you, I've tried to speak to you about what I see to be the two possible general results within an individual human life in the aftermath of going sane, the possibility of withdrawing from human society and human discourse, and the possibility of engaging with human society and human discourse. I hope I've been helpful. And I think we should take a little break. Let's take a little break now and come back in 5 minutes, okay? Let's just take a break. Stretch our legs, take a breath, and come back in 5 minutes. Thank you very much for being here. Okay, this is John again. We're back. I hope you're all back. I don't have anything more that I need to say here today except in conversation with you, so if anybody wants to talk about what we talked about this morning with me, or I guess anything else, but I'd rather talk about this, raise your hand. Stephen?
Can you hear me, John?
I do, yes.
Okay, great. I'm not quite clear on this continuing process. You often say, I think you say this, that looking need only happen once or something like that. And so why would there be any ongoing need or continuing process?
Well, because the looking needs only to happen once, but the direct effect of the looking is very affects only the context of fearfulness and anxiety. It does not affect the results of a life lived through the lens distorted by the idea that that life is fearful and not to be trusted. All of the ways that we have, and you know, it's difficult to speak about these things. I speak as if the psychology is you, when obviously it's not. But, you know, we just have to speak as we can.
Could you just say that again? The looking only affects the fear and anxiety itself?
No, it only, here's the thing.
Okay, try it again.
What I speak of as the fear of life is a context. It's not an experience. It is the context that is triggered at the most likely, and from all accounts, I think it's pretty sure. It's the context that appears in response to the terror that attends the birth of most human beings. Not every human being, certainly, but most human beings. So that moment of terror that comes from the violence and kind of craziness of being born, that moment of terror sets the mind into a context that is based on an assumption that things are really dangerous here, that there's something here that is really to be feared and watched out for. So that becomes the underlying assumption within which all of the ways that we understand things, all of the ways that we relate to things, all of our ideas about the nature of things, all of our the habits and assumptions that that accrue over a lifetime of development, they are all diseased. They are contaminated by having appeared within a context where the assumption is that life as a human being is dangerous and not to be trusted. They stay. They don't disappear like dust in the wind. They stay until the cause and effect process of the regeneration of the psychology itself is finished. And until that occurs, and God knows how long it takes, I'm not sure that it ever ends for those of us who've been around for a while. But as that process unfolds, when they're all gone, then they're all gone. But the thing I'm trying to say is that the presence of those psychological mechanisms that no longer are valid, the presence of those invalid psychological mechanisms persists for a while. You know, it was, to give you an example of what I'm talking about, it was, let me see, I guess at least 8 or 10 years after what I did that I later came to see to be the act of looking, it was 8 or 10 years later when I just kind of automatically quit smoking cigarettes. And that's an example of a psychological mechanism that came into being in some twisted reaction in response to my experience of life as being unsatisfying and not to be trusted and not worth living, really. That habitual psychological mechanism that connected safety and satisfaction with the addiction to nicotine, that psychological mechanism persisted for a very long time. And then there came a moment, and this is an important thing to see, and I use my experience with this because it's a pretty clear and concrete one. There came a moment when I don't even remember when, a number of years ago, when I went out to smoke a cigarette in the evening, and I noticed that a thought that I was very familiar with, I noticed a thought that I was very familiar with appear, which was the insight that smoking cigarettes is going to kill me. And and that they're dangerous and they should not be done. But that the thought continued, but if that's the case, the damage is already done, so there's no point in me quitting now. And I recognized that as it appeared to be a thought that was consistently appearing every time I had a cigarette, all the time, every time that thought appeared. This time, when I saw that thought, a thought came behind it that said, yeah, well, it might be too late, but it certainly isn't too early. And I have never smoked a cigarette, never had the desire to smoke a cigarette since that moment when that diseased thought disappeared. Now, that's a particularly physical and concrete example, but that same process applies to all of the ways in which we have engaged with life in a manner that is self-defeating and self-denying and insane, really. It applies to all of those things. Some of them as concrete and as big a problem as smoking cigarettes. Some of them just little things, you know, about, oh, look at that. I remember when I used to, like a couple seconds ago, I remember when I used to have real bad feelings about the people driving in cars because they were so stupid. And then that went away. And so that what I'm trying to get at, and I hope that my examples are clear, and I'm afraid they may not be, but what I'm trying to get at is that's the process that begins only when the context of fear is gone. And again, the context of fear is not an experience. It is an assumption, a silent assumption that contaminates the entire psychological mechanism that appears and develops and changes and moves and so forth within it. And does that help at all?
John?
Yeah.
John?
Yeah.
I've got something to say right here that has that's different. All the time that you were talking, I was muted by Carla. And I was wanting to have a conversation with you. I mean, you say interesting things, and I really do love to just sit here and listen. But that's not what I was trying to do. I was trying to have a conversation. This happened the last time I tried to speak. And as far as I know, it happens each time with other people. I would really like to ask that I not be muted when we're speaking.
Sure, no problem. I mean, there's a reason for it, but there's no problem.
I don't know what the
reason
is. It
often happens that there's extraneous noise and so forth.
Yeah, if there's noise or something, then that could be dealt with, but
Okay, great.
You know, I kind of wondered why these meetings seem to have a certain tone, and I think that's the reason. I don't know if other people are experiencing that or not, but my guess is that they probably are.
It's a different the technology has its limitations.
Well, I don't think it's the technology. I mean, you and I are having a conversation right now, right? No problem.
Right.
This is what I want.
Right. Okay, you got it.
Okay, so way back at the beginning, you talk about context, and I don't know what that word means. I have no experience of what a context is. And in a way, it's important. I mean, we use words here, so it's important to have some kind of understanding, I guess.
What I mean by a context is a set of unexamined, assumptions set of unexamined assumptions. That's what I mean by the context.
Okay, so we're little babies or something, and we have some fear. Now, how does that create a context? I mean, it creates fear. It creates
okay,
there's.
Oh, hold on, wait a minute. Yeah. I understand the question. Okay.
Okay.
Consider this. All right. Mm-hmm. Here we are. We are fetuses. I'm a fetus.
Okay.
And my life as a fetus is, and I'm certainly, you know, have a growing self-consciousness that grows over time. And my life as a fetus is like heaven. There's my experience, my entire experience of life is to be in a gentle, rocking, warm fluid with the sound of my mother's heartbeat, and nothing harms me, nothing causes me any difficulty. I mean, there are ways in which we can cause trauma to fetuses prior to birth, but I'm just taking this as the normal experience of fetus in the womb. Everything is fine. I'm not really aware of much of anything. I'm kind of slumbering and just floating and drifting now. And that's all I know. That's life. If I had the capacity to have thoughts about it, I would think this is pretty cool and this is my life. And I'm really fine with it. And then, all of a sudden, I am ejected from that environment. I am forcibly ejected from that environment, and I find myself without warning in a world in which there is cold air, bright light, noise, movement, everything going crazy, pain, and it is in that moment when that assumption is set. In that very moment, the assumption that life is to be distrusted and feared is set right then. And that's why it happens. Okay?
You're describing a traumatic event, yes, and I can guess that that's probably the case.
It's a traumatic event that has no peer. The ejection from the womb has no like trauma that it can be compared to.
Well, I guess my point here is I don't want to debate that so much. I mean, I think there could be other approaches and interpretations of that. I have some ideas like that, but I'm not interested in debating it. I'm just saying that you're saying that there's a context created, a set of assumptions. I don't, how do you experience a context?
You don't, obviously you don't directly experience it. The context is the container of experience. You don't directly experience the context. That's what I'm telling you. And I'm going to say something else when I'm done here, so give me a moment here. The context is silent. The context is not experience. There's no experience whatsoever of the context of fearfulness that within adult life. That's not the direct experience of anything. It's there. That's all. And the other thing I wanted to say about all of this is that I started seeing this possibility a number of years ago. And it only became, and I was distrustful of it. I am not very in love with the ideas that I come up with, really. And I was very distrustful of it. It seemed a little pat.
I know what you mean.
But what has happened over the years since that first occurred and I began to suggest it is that the actual experience of people who have come to this act of looking is pretty much with almost no exceptions, it is confirmatory of the entire scheme that I am presenting to be the case. I also, I don't know, have you read the paper called The Radical Act that's on the website?
No, I haven't.
Well, I would recommend that you do because that is a paper that is, and I'm trying to tell you what it is. It's a paper that is in the process of being presented to peer-reviewed journals in the world of psychology. Mm-hmm. And it's written by two psychologists and a psychiatrist about their view and understanding of the importance and the validity of this work, and in particular of the insight into the effect of the birth trauma on infants. And that, plus even more important than that, is the confirmation that we've received from, I mean, hundreds of people that is confirmatory to the whole thing that I'm suggesting as what's going on here. I mean, this isn't something I just pulled out of my hat, out of my ear.
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly agree that that almost everybody's sort of unexamined, how can I say it, posture, activity, context is of basically a fearfulness and or protection. Even the you could say, well, there's the whole desire and pleasure part and all that, but
that too.
Yeah, I would agree. So, I mean, I agree with the process. I can see it, you know. I'm wondering if, how can I say this? I'm interested partly because I'm interested in, how can I say this? That, like, the process here, the technology, if you will. I mean, something's going on. Your whole thing here is that in a way that you have uncovered, discovered, a much more direct way, much more effective way of, undoing all of this than has yet really been uncovered or discovered, right?
Yeah, it's really bizarre, isn't it?
Well,
it's more
whatever.
Bizarre to me than it is to you.
Well, I'm not saying it's interesting. I don't, you know, it doesn't matter where it comes from or whatever. But so if that's the case, then it could be true also that there's even more refinements, or as you're saying, this is a living thing, you know. So that's why I'm asking these kinds of questions. I'm really interested in the fundamental process and with a sense of, you know, how does this get undone? And in a way, I think we could all say, in a way, it doesn't really matter. You know, if you do the looking and stuff takes place, you know, something happens. But
see, that's not what I think.
Well, okay, what do you think?
I think that the most important thing now is to get everybody to do the act, number one. The time for honing and perfecting and polishing my or anybody else's understanding of what happens has moved away into a different realm, and the time has come where we have seen enough to know one thing for sure, and that is that this works. So that the most critical interest for me is to find out directly by getting the suggestion to everybody. Since it's only the suggestion that needs to be gotten, the act is almost certain to take place if you ask people to do it and explain what it is. So that, let me finish. So that, yeah, that's the most critical thing for me right now. But that's just what's the priority. What I think is that when the insanity departs from the human community, or at least begins to depart from the human community, that we will find a range of things that are of interest to us and that might be helpful to us, and that might bring deeper understanding of things that are wondrous to understand. I am very much in favor of that. It's just that that's not what I'm doing right now.
Well, I'm talking about exactly that, though. I'm talking about, I'm talking about getting people to do the looking. I've, you know, said it to different folks, and some with some success and some not. And it occurs to me that when there isn't success, at least as far as I know, maybe they go home and do it. I don't know. But
as far as you know.
As far as I know, yeah. That it's largely because I can't really explain it very well. I can't really say, it's like it's so dismissible in a sense that, they dismiss it, you know?
But the thing is, and this is interesting, the thing is, and believe me, I understand what you're saying, but what we've seen is that actually, if you suggest it to people and you tell them what it consists in, so that the description is not contaminated with metaphysical and other ideas about things, if you tell it to them cleanly and clearly enough and describe the act to them, our experience is that they do it. And whether they dismiss it or don't dismiss it, for me, the important thing is that they do it, because I am persuaded that, perhaps not 100%, but I am persuaded that almost anyone who actually tries to do the act will succeed, and the consequences will begin to unfold. It's not necessary to get, what I'm saying is it's not necessary to get agreement. It's
okay.
Not necessary to get that. That's
okay.
That's why this is so simple.
Does it, well, okay, so that leads me into my first question, the beginning of my question, which is, so if it's not necessary to get agreement, and you say that often people have no particular experience that they can point to or anything, so it might go on for months, years, before they would even notice anything, let alone connect it to something that they tried and thought didn't happen, right?
Well,
that could be true, right?
We've seen that happen, yes. And
yeah.
And certainly we have seen that happen, and it actually is the fact of that happening. And people, and what we have seen is that people can get very confused and just kind of go away for a long time. But more and more, those same folks are coming back and saying, you know what, I get it now. But that's the reason why I have, you know, in the beginning, I was reluctant to say anything at all in a persuasive and a kind of a non-violent argumentative sense, right, about this stuff. And it was partly that, and partly the growth of confidence in my own confidence in the act itself, confidence in my understanding of what's happened in the act, that has brought me to the point where now I actually do things like what we're doing here and try to speak with people and talk to them directly and argumentatively about what I see to be the case and so forth and so on. In fact, what we're thinking about doing now in that vein is, and precisely because in order to provide some support for those who kind of did it casually or didn't know what was happening or whatever, what we're planning to do is to make a series of these webinars instead of doing five-day intensives of this nature, although we may continue that too. We're going to do a series of introductory webinars that people can take part in when in the very beginning of it, where
uh-huh.
we come to these matters and talk
that
about
sounds
them.
Good.
And that's a new thing. That's something that a couple of years ago I would have dismissed.
Well, no, that sounds good, actually.
Now I see, yeah.
So, but then my final part of the, my original part of the question has to do with this continuing act. And which is, I don't really understand what you're saying, because in a sense you're saying it doesn't matter if there is any conscious anything afterwards, let alone a continuation in some way, you know, doing, practicing something.
Right. Well,
and then on the other hand, you seem to be saying that that's important.
Yeah.
So I'm confused.
Because what I'm saying is that it's my experience, and it's the experience has been reported by a number of people. Mm-hmm. It's my experience that in the beginning, after the first looking, I used to say to people, just look once, and then whenever it occurs to you to do so. And right. I wanted to be clear to them that they should not see it as something that was desperately important for them to make sure that they do it and, you know, and so forth and so on.
Okay.
But what I've seen since then is that it's actually the case that when people do it, they find themselves looking again for a while. They'll report on the fact that in some of them, like, they do it almost as a practice for a while. But then over time, that just kind of vanishes away, the interest in the act of looking itself, because the act of looking itself isn't all that interesting. It's not, you know, it doesn't give you much of anything. Mm-hmm. And so it's fine. I don't care. People can try to continue looking, not try to continue looking. It is of no consequence so far as I can see. But what is of consequence, and they certainly don't need to try to keep looking, what is consequential is to begin working, because of what I said, which is that what happens is a invalidation of everything that was brought into being based on the assumption of the fact that life cannot be trusted and is dangerous. Mm-hmm. That begins to disintegrate. But it doesn't all go at once. And like I said, it took like however many years until the smoking thing happened, which is a good example of a negative psychological trope there.
Right.
But that what we have learned in the, I used to tell people, you know, you're going to feel bad and you're going to be confused, but it'll be over with in due time. And just be patient with it and everything will be okay. And then, as I began to see more of what was actually happening, as more and more people began to speak with us about it, I began to tell people that it would be useful for them to learn mindfulness meditation. And I recommended mindfulness meditation in the form of focusing the attention on the sensation of the breath and counting breath and starting over to 10 and then starting over again when attention was hijacked by something and they forgot where they were. And that, because
go on, maybe you'll answer the question.
And
the reason for doing that, the reason for recommending that is what?
The reason for recommending
this is what I'm not quite getting.
As because, well, see, again, my understanding is incremental, right? That was one step in me getting to the point where I am now. It was precisely because of the fact that I could see that learning how to deliberately control attention would be really useful at any time. I saw it in those terms. That there might as well be strengthening and clarifying their ability to attend to things rather than worrying about all the stuff that was going crazy. But then, as a result of conversations with a bunch of people, and among them David Parrish, I came to the understanding to see very clearly that this was not like we used to call it a recovery period, you know, because that actually seems also to be a reasonable metaphor for what's happening there. So we used to call it a period of recovery, and we would do the mindfulness training as a way of easing the pain of the period of recovery. And then I saw finally that really, this is not a period of recovery. The disease is gone. The symptoms of the disease and the form of disease mechanisms still persist, but the disease is gone. So that at that moment, when the inexplicable kind of craziness of the psychology going crazy starts to occur, that actually is mostly what's happening there, is that we have lost the ability to maintain the delusion that we are separate from the experience of life as it unfolds, so that what we are experiencing along with that gives rise to all this crazy psychology, what we are experiencing really is the unfamiliar experience of life actually rushing in on us. And that led me to see that from my own experience, that the ability to attend to things and to choose what you attend to deliberately by your own choice was perhaps the only thing we can do deliberately by will. And that learning, that training, that beginning to train ourselves from the first moment that we find ourselves kind of again ejected from the womb, from the very first moment that we find ourselves face to face with life as it is, we should begin to try to deliberately understand and work with the movement of our attention in a way that mitigates and actually hastens the process of recovery, so that the process of regeneration, so that it doesn't take quite so long, and it is seen in a light not as something to be endured, but as the first instance of the opportunity to begin to learn to live life as a human being living without that separation from life.
So the idea then really is to, as you say, to shorten that process, the uncomfortable or difficult part of the process, but
partly,
something like that.
But the great thing about it is, the really, really fine thing about it is that by doing that, it will certainly hasten the time when all of the confusion will disappear. But also, you're doing something that will serve you for the rest of your life. You are learning and gaining strength and clarity and intelligence in doing the only thing that you can really do, and that will serve you for the rest of your life. And you're starting right now. You're not waiting until you feel better. And it is the case that ability to do that actually does reduce the intensity of the misery that is this, you know, regeneration process, and teaches you how to live as a human being. So it's the whole thing, right? The regeneration, the disintegration and the craziness that's going on in the psychology, in the personality, however you want to call it, that craziness is the actual experience of your life. At that time, you are no longer protected from that experience by shielding yourself behind a delusion that you can hide behind thought and so forth. You're directly experiencing the way your life's unfolding. And that's part of the unfolding of the life at that time. That'll change. Life, it doesn't always feel like that, but it does in the beginning. And I think that's a much saner and a human way of approaching this.
Yeah, for me, I did a lot of Zen study over the years, and I was never able to make any improvement on my attention whatsoever at all. That's 30 years worth of meditation, you know. And I come to finally just say, okay, you know, whatever's driving this boat, it sure isn't my attempts to do this. Even if I think I'm doing it, what I sort of see as it's happening is that something appears. Some sensation of, the breath, you know. And then, you know, I know that kind of feels good, so I'll go there in a few seconds, moments, whatever. And that's sweet. But, you know, I don't I have no idea how that happens, you know. And repetition doesn't seem to affect it.
And of course,
for me,
you know, I've done a lot of meditation too. I had 18 and a half years in a federally funded monastery.
That's right.
And I've done considerable meditation too. And this is not that. This is the actual living of your life. And I tell you that, I promise you. And I'm not saying that, I mean, I have no quarrel with meditation. I have no quarrel with what you're speaking of at all. But this isn't that. This is the direct living of your life.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Actually, I'm agreeing with you. Cause I really don't know what meditation is, and whatever I've done that somebody else called it or I called it is whatever, fine. Have at it. It's good. I love it. I think it's great. So, but I don't think that that's what's going on here at all. You know, I agree with you. It's life or this vividness, you know?
Yes, right.
And so it's confusing, you know? So what? Maybe that's the very essence of, maybe that's what it takes to kind of grind open, you know?
Yeah, but you see, here's the thing. That understanding comes to you from your experience of life. It comes to you from the experience you've had over the course of your life. That understanding has somehow forced its way out into the open in you. Okay?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I guess so.
But that understanding does not eliminate the cause of the problem in the first place. No understanding will do away with the underlying assumption of untrustworthiness and dangerousness in life. No amount of that will do that. And which is not to diminish what you're doing, you know, at all. I'm not.
What I'm doing.
I mean, what it is that you're describing to me. I'm just trying to see if we are talking about the same thing.
Yeah. I'm not saying I'm doing anything. if anything, I'm but what I'm saying is, it's like, okay, so the confusion, the intensity of life, as you say, it starts to appear, you might say. You could say it this way, right? That's what you're saying?
Well,
that's similar to what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that the blindfold has been taken off, whatever metaphor you want to use for that, and what has previously been experienced at a imaginary distance, the unpredictability of the way life unfolds and so forth, is now right in your face, immediately without preparation when this context goes. And not everybody has the same intensity of difficulty in the aftermath of the looking. There's a definite, a range of experience that's consistent with the fact that human beings are actually, human psychology is actually unique. Each human psychological mechanism is unique to that individual human being, and it's always changing too. So that not everybody experiences the period following the looking with the same intensity of confusion and so forth as others. But anyway, I don't know why I said that. We're running out of time too.
Okay.
Okay?
Sure.
Good to talk to you.
Sure, absolutely.
And so we're going to quit. Is that all right? Is there something you want to say first that I'm stopping you from saying?
Me? No, I'm fine. Thanks.
Okay, so that's it for today. That's it for today. I hope it was useful to you. I know that I'll see you tomorrow.
You just listened to meeting number 4 of a 5-day online intensive with John Sherman, broadcast live from Ojai, California on June 27th, 2013. For more live recordings, visit our podcast at www.justoneloop.org.